there's roughly a 1 in 10 chance that in your 20s and 30s, you were dealing with a gynecologic problem known as polycystic ovarian syndrome, commonly known as PCOS, and may be wondering what effect, if any, that will have on your health years later. Well, wonder no more. Today, I'm having a conversation with reproductive endocrinologist Dr. Allison Rogers about the impact of PCOS later in life. I'm Dr. Lauren Stryker, a gynecologist, best-selling author, and a nationally recognized menopause expert. When it comes to menopause, midlife, and what comes after, I'm betting you've not gotten a lot of information from your own doctor. If women are given good information, they'll make good choices. And I'm here to give you the inside information. When I first learned about PCOS during my training, I was told that once a woman with PCOS hit menopause, irregular periods, excess hair growth, dealing with fertility problems, and other manifestations of PCOS were in the rearview mirror. And that's true. But we now know that women who have PCOS during the reproductive years are not entirely off the hook down the road, and that PCOS early in life is associated with a number of health issues later in life. But before I bring in Dr. Rogers to talk about the impact of PCOS postmenopause, I'm going to tell you a little about how PCOS was discovered and my small part in the PCOS story. This story started way before I was a gynecologist and actually before I was even born. In the 1930s, long before fertility was a specialty, long before things like insemination, Clomid, and IVF existed, Chicago gynecologists Irving Stein and Michael Leventhal realized they had a significant number of patients with fertility problems that had similar traits, irregular periods, acne, and excessive facial hair. And they also noticed that many of those women had enlarged ovaries. Being curious and research-oriented, they decided to take a closer look. Keep in mind, in the 1930s, ultrasound, MRIs, and CT scans didn't exist. A closer look meant surgery, major surgery. So 7 of their infertile patients underwent general anesthesia and had belly button to pubic bone incisions in order to see exactly what was going on. What Drs. Stein and Leventhal found was enlarged ovaries, as they suspected, but what they didn't expect was the appearance of those ovaries that were loaded with dozens of pearl-like cysts. They'd never seen anything like it. So they did what surgeons do. They cut a great big chunk out of the ovaries for further study. And then something unexpected happened. Once the women recovered from surgery, they started to menstruate regularly and in most cases, quickly conceived. Not only did they identify a new disease, they'd found the cure. They published their findings in 1935, and for the next 50 years, the constellation of irregular periods and excessive hair growth, infertility, and enlarged ovaries were known everywhere as Stein-Leventhal syndrome. And gynecologists all over the country performed major surgery on their infertile patients to remove a chunk of ovary, which in many of those cases resulted in successful pregnancies. It was standard treatment. When Dr. Leventhal died in 1971, Chicago lore has it that hundreds of grateful women showed up and sobbed at his funeral. So, years later, I did my residency at Michael Reese Hospital, where the legacy of Stein-Leventhal was a huge part of my training. And after I finished my residency, I joined one of the subsequent generations from the original Stein-Leventhal practice. Many of my elderly patients with long scars on their bellies told me firsthand how they owed having a family to Dr. Leventhal. Fast forward to today. Stein-Leventhal syndrome is now known as polycystic ovarian syndrome, PCOS, a condition that affects up to 1 in 10 women and fortunately no longer requires a surgical diagnosis or treatment. So there you have it. I love the two curious Chicago docs had such an enormous impact on so many women. And while the world knows this condition is PCOS, to me, it will always be Stein-Leventhal syndrome. And with that, I'm going to bring in reproductive endocrinologist Dr. Allison Rogers to discuss the impact of PCOS early in life and later in life. So welcome, Dr. Rogers.
Thank you so much for having me.
I'm really been looking forward to this because, you know, Stein-Leventhal has been near and dear to me. So our first question, when you were training and you're younger than I am, had you ever even heard about Stein and Leventhal?
Yes, absolutely. I think that this is something that I learned about in medical school as well as residency, but it was kind of like a historical sort of how things were figured out, that kind of thing. I mean, I am having my 20th year medical school reunion, so it's been a hot minute since I was in medical school. So yes, I think those names were still names that I've known, but I don't think anyone uses them anymore.
No, I mean, right now, if I were to ask a medical student or resident, have you ever heard of Cyan Leventhal? I would get the blank stare. So we are, kind of on that, I hate to say it, that generation that is forgetting where this started from. And I do think I'm one of those people that I'm a medical history buff. And it's so interesting to go back and learn not only how much we've learned, but really what nobody knew. I mean, we just did not know. And then I always think, okay, well, we think we're so smart. 50 years from now, there's going to be some snarky young doctor saying, can you believe that they gave chemotherapy to people with cancer to poison them? And, just the things that we take for granted are just not going to be the same. So
Yeah, absolutely.
that's the nature of medicine. And that's why when everyone says to me, well, you were wrong when you told women XYZ, and it's not that we were wrong. That was the state of medical knowledge at that time, and this all evolved. So that's why it's so exciting. All right, before we get to the impact of PCOS later in life, which let's just start off with the basics to make sure that we're all on the same page. What exactly is polycystic ovarian syndrome?
Sure. So PCOS, as we like to call it, is a metabolic disorder. Typically, there is a spectrum from very mild to more severe. The way I like to explain it is that our pituitary gland in our brain is supposed to send a signal down to our ovary to make an egg every month, and that signal just doesn't make it down to the ovary. And so we have a situation where because of this hormone imbalance, we have not ovulating, not exposure to progesterone, and that has short-term and long-term health effects. And it is a very common disorder. The common things we think about are irregular cycles, ultrasound with lots of eggs. And some people really struggle with lots of extra hair in places they don't want it, and it can be very disruptive to their life. Other people have regular cycles and don't really notice a whole lot, but it's a spectrum and it's very common.
Yeah. And it's interesting because certainly when I learned about PCOS, it wasn't really thought of as being a metabolic syndrome. It was simply women that had fertility problems because they had this funky stuff going on with their ovaries. And at that time, no one even knew or certainly thought about the health implications, even beyond infertility at the time. So can you talk a little bit about for young women, before we get to the midlife women, for young women who have PCOS, what kinds of health concerns do they have beyond difficulty getting pregnant?
Right. So, because when you ovulate, you produce progesterone, that progesterone really acts very protective to the uterus and to other organs. And so, you have a lot of estrogen without counterbalancing with progesterone. And so, we can see the growth of the lining of the uterus. So, we can see things like uterine polyps. We can see increased risk for endometrial hyperplasia, which is a precancerous condition, or even uterine cancer. Obviously, that's usually not young women. We see things like diabetes, high blood pressure, cardiovascular disease, being overweight or having obesity, high cholesterol levels. So it really can kind of wreak havoc on, and then certainly diabetes, really can wreak havoc on all of our metabolic processes in our body, besides just not being able to get pregnant or having a little extra hair.
For me, I think that was the first wake-up call as a young physician that PCOS was a lot more than infertility problems when we started seeing young women. As you said, young women generally are not at risk for uterine cancer. And yet, we were starting to see these young women who were coming in with uterine cancer because of that abnormal buildup in the lining of the uterus from not ovulating. And they would come in with just heavy periods. And normally, you don't go ahead and do biopsies on 30-year-olds that have heavy periods because uterine cancer was so rare. And now we know, oh yeah, you got to pay attention. You have to check out any abnormal bleeding in these women because they do have a very high risk. And of course, these things can all be prevented. And that's the whole point of recognizing and getting care so that they don't get these problems. The other thing that really struck me about what we know about young women now is the impact that it has on even young women in terms of having elevated triglycerides and other cardiovascular issues. So can you talk for a minute about that?
Sure. So, there is this insulin resistance that comes with PCOS that certainly increases your risk of diabetes, but also affects the normal lipids or cholesterol levels in your system. Now, we need cholesterol. We always think about cholesterol being this bad thing. As a reproductive endocrinologist, cholesterol is a great thing because it's the starting building block of all of our major reproductive hormones. So, estrogen, progesterone, testosterone, all of those amazing hormones that we need, it's the building block. However, obviously, high levels of cholesterol certainly can cause, lifelong problems in terms of creating, plaques in our vessels, increasing risk of heart attack. Women die of heart attacks because they don't have always the same symptoms, but there's lots of women who we think about sort of heart attacks being in old men, but it can happen in women too, and we need to protect our hearts.
Yeah, absolutely. And the thing that jumps out at me as you start to kind of go through this list of things that can happen is there's this idea, and the part of a lot of young women is, well, if I don't care about getting pregnant, who cares if I never get a period? Who cares if I have a little extra hair growth? It's not bothering me. But the message loud and clear that I'm hearing from you is you don't ignore this stuff, even if getting pregnant is not on the agenda.
So I think a lot of us feel that getting a period is like a vital sign, right? It's like your blood pressure, it's like your weight, maybe it's sort of an indication of sort of how your body's doing, and all kinds of systems need to be working properly for you to get a period. So there's lots of reasons why people don't get periods. Typically, all of them need to be treated, right? I
Well, except
mean,
pregnancy. Come on. The number one
you need
reason.
treatment in pregnancy too.
That's true. The number one reason for not getting a period is pregnancy.
100%.
I mean,
If you
how many
haven't gotten
times
your
did we
period,
hear that in medical school? It was like
yes.
driven into us. What is the number one reason for missing a period?
Yep, true story. I love that. But I think that if you're a young woman, you think, this is going to happen to me when I'm older. I don't need to worry about it now. But like you said, you're at risk for uterine cancer early, or at least uterine polyps, which can cause very heavy irregular cycles, as well as, I think that everyone wants to have sort of normal metabolism. Nobody wants diabetes. Nobody wants difficulty with the way their bodies can sleep or process sugars.
And speaking of that, when we think typically of women who have PCOS, we think of women that are overweight, but that's not always the case, is it?
That is a very good point. Now, a lot of people in the United States, especially, are overweight with and without PCOS. And weight in and of itself, even just being overweight without the PCOS, can cause infertility. However, while some people and a lot of people who have PCOS are overweight, not all PCOS patients are overweight. And even the normal weight patients with PCOS are at risk for these lifelong health complications.
Yeah. How common is it?
In our patient population, obviously, I see mainly fertility patients. So it's a little bit of a
So for you,
different
it's like what,
population.
90% of people that
I'm
walk in the door?
not maybe that high, but probably like
Yeah.
20, 25%,
Yeah,
right?
but in the
I think
general
that in
population.
the general population, we see around, 5 to 10% having PCOS. And this is a very common disorder.
All right. So this is my big question. I have read recent studies that show that there's a genetic predisposition for getting PCOS, that this is something that you are just born with this tendency and that it's nothing that you can change, it's nothing you can modify, as opposed to other things that I've read that said, no, PCOS can be a consequence. It's the chicken or the egg thing. If someone is overweight, if someone has maybe other metabolic issues, it causes PCOS. So do we know what causes it? And then there's a difference also between treating it, managing it, and making it go away. So first, the first question, what
Yeah,
causes
so
it?
let's talk about sort of the genetics behind PCOS. So We truly do not completely understand, even in 2024, all what that makes people have it or not have it, what makes it more severe versus less severe. We know certainly there's a familial component. I hear people all the time who say, "Oh yeah, my sister has PCOS, she doesn't get periods." But you also talk to people who you say, "Oh, my sister's got pregnant. I don't know why I can't get pregnant and I don't get periods," right? And think so it's very multifactorial. And I shame on whoever is telling people that they just need to like lose weight or eat better to get their PCOS to go away, right? This is a metabolic disorder.
But people say that. You hear that, don't you, all the time, right?
Yes, and
That's
it's
where women
not
come in and are
true.
told, lose weight and you'll get pregnant.
Patients tell me that all that they've heard that from other providers all the time, but I think that it creates a lot of shame and like fault, like it's somebody's
You're blaming
fault.
them. You're saying it's your fault.
Yes,
It's your
it's
fault
horrible.
that you don't get periods. It's your fault that you can't get pregnant. Yeah, it is.
Yes. No, that's not accurate, right? And so while we don't have like one gene that we know, it's not like it's something that we can test for like other disease states, like you have it or you don't have it. It's very multifactorial. There's clearly a huge spectrum of the way people present with
Yeah.
this, right? Some people are more mild, some people are more severe, but this is certainly something that is not just like lose a little weight because we know
Right.
there's people who are normally weight with PCOS.
Well, that was my point. So, but one of the reasons I ask is that a lot of the women that are listening to this, they're past the reproductive years, but they have daughters. And it may be that they're thinking, okay, well, if I had PCOS, is this something that my daughters are more likely to get than in the general population? And do we know the answer to that question?
So, I don't think we totally with like as with some other things like endometriosis or something have it as well elucidated, but there is a familial component. If you're somebody who struggled with PCOS and once your daughters start getting through puberty, like a lot of us who have daughters in puberty and they're not getting regular cycles, I think it's important to just make sure they're educated and evaluated.
So when we talk about PCOS, we talk about managing it, of course, and the
Versus
management
treating
is
it.
going to be different for someone who wants to get pregnant versus someone who doesn't want to get pregnant, and then treating it.
Can we give you a pill to treat the metabolic disorder? No. We can give you a pill to get you regular cycles. I can get you a pill to ovulate. I can give you a pill to help with blood pressure, diabetes, cholesterol, but it doesn't treat the sort of underlying risk that you have from this metabolic disorder. So you can't cure it.
Okay, but let me ask you this, because this is what I'm trying to be very clear about in my head, and I want everyone to be clear about. Let's say you see a young woman who's, 30, 35 years old, known PCOS, no interest in fertility, and her gynecologist has put her on a birth control pill because she's not making progesterone to make sure that she doesn't have that buildup in the lining of the uterus, to make sure that she's getting both her estrogen and her progesterone from the pill. And she feels pretty good. Everything's just fine. She's on a pill continuously. She's not getting periods, but we don't care because she's on a birth control pill. Does she otherwise need to be treated for these potential metabolic issues that are associated with PCOS, or does that depend on what her particular blood work shows or some other parameter that you might look at?
What I typically do is I tell my patients that they're at increased risk for all of the things. Let's go through them. High blood pressure, diabetes, high cholesterol, things like heart attacks. We talked about uterine cancer, other like sleep apnea and other things that kind of go along with metabolic disorder, and that they need for the rest of their life good routine medical care to make sure that they're healthy and that they're being screened. Obviously getting a yearly blood pressure check, making sure your hemoglobin A1C is normal to make sure you're not developing diabetes. When we think about metabolic weight, right, we think about this whole concept of sort of the apple versus the pear. If we think about sort of the average female figure, it's curvy. There's a lot of weight that's in the hips and the bottom. And if we think about people with metabolic disorders, they usually have pretty skinny legs, pretty skinny arms, and they carry a lot of that weight in centrally. And
Yeah.
that central weight that people carry around their abdomen really increases the risks of things like cardiovascular disease, heart attacks, more than carrying weight in your lower legs, lower body. Yeah. And we look at sort of the differences in cholesterol, right? The HDL versus the LDL. HDL is that high density lipids that is typically considered protective. And in a lot of women, that HDL is nice and high. We don't see that as much in people with metabolic disorders and people with PCOS as they go through life. We see that that ratio of LDL to HDL is different. And so that's what increases the risks even further.
I want to circle back a little bit because you mentioned sleep apnea. And I have also read that young women with PCOS have an increased risk of sleep apnea. My question, and I don't know if there's an answer for this, but my question is this a downstream effect of being overweight that's associated with PCOS, or is a young woman who has a normal weight also at increased risk of sleep apnea just because she has PCOS? You know, is it a consequence of the metabolic alteration, or is it a consequence of her weight? One of the things I've thought about, and in fairness, I know this hasn't been studied, but I always like talking to smart people like you just to get your thoughts on this. In menopause, we know that obstructive sleep apnea increases significantly in women when their estrogen and progesterone levels drop, and that there's actual changes in the larynx, in the epiglottis, which not only causes them to be more likely to have sleep apnea, but also for there to be voice changes. And a lot of this is because of this increase in androgens, which we also see in PCOS.
Yeah.
So it's kind of an interesting thought of maybe that, I'm just making this up, but maybe that's why women with PCOS are at higher risk of sleep apnea. And it has nothing to do with the fact that they do often have a tendency to carry more weight. Maybe it is a direct consequence of the hormonal and metabolic changes.
Just it would be really
there.
Interesting.
I don't
to study
know. I don't think anyone's ever studied that.
I think that that's a really interesting sort of thought.
Yeah. Yeah. No, it would be kind of cool to do a study on that. We'll put that on the list of studies we need.
Sounds
to do.
Good.
That list that keeps getting longer. Okay. So let's talk about the woman who's PCOS. She's been beautifully managed. She's your patient. She's had her 7 children. She's running. She's in great shape. And she's now 46, 47 years old and starting to think about perimenopause and menopause. And she is so happy. She is so happy because she thinks that as soon as she is done being in those reproductive years, that PCOS is in her rearview mirror. What are you going to tell her?
When we were talking earlier about the fact that you go through menopause and then it's over, but it's not over.
It's never just over until you die. Yeah. I mean, how often have people heard me say that?
Her periods may be in her rearview mirror, but PCOS is something that stays with you for a lifetime. The risks of significant medical diseases will be higher at every age compared to the woman who never had PCOS because of the sort of genetic predisposition, the metabolic disturbances in terms of some of the inflammation and oxidative stress that cause risks of things like diabetes, cholesterol issues, and obviously we talk risks of uterine cancer, those kind of things. So now it sounds like the person you're describing exercises and been taking care of themselves and has had a lot of good control. So that certainly decreases their risks overall, but doesn't probably take it down to a person without PCOS.
To the general population. One of the studies I was looking at said that women that have PCOS tend to enter menopause later. On average, the average age to have that menopause transition from peri to postmenopause is usually 51 to 52 in the United States. But PCOS patients, according to this one study I saw, entered menopause about 4 years later. Is that something that's commonly thought of, or is just something that was in this particular study group?
You know, I think that's so fascinating because it makes sense, right? Like when I'm seeing these patients, that's when they start getting the regular periods, is when they're in their mid 40s. They're just starting to have their egg count drop to the point where their ovaries are actually functioning a little better. Now their eggs are not healthy anymore, but their ovaries are sort of releasing eggs in a more regular way because their egg count has dropped. It doesn't surprise me, but I haven't seen any studies sort of showing that. And I've never necessarily heard that before, but it doesn't mean it's not true. Yeah. So it's really interesting. I see a lot of women who tell me, I was told I have PCOS because my periods used to be irregular, but now they're are a little more regular. And these are women typically in their 40s who are ready to have a baby who maybe had PCOS. And I checked their egg count. It's certainly above average for their age, but still in the normal range. And so do I think that PCOS, the symptoms of the ovarian function get better, you know, as our egg count starts to drop in our 40s? Yes, it makes sense from a sort of biological perspective.
Yeah. The other thing also that I was trying to look up and I really couldn't find is that we talked about that young women with PCOS have this increased risk of developing uterine cancer because they're not ovulating and because of the buildup in the lining of the uterus. But if we fast forward to postmenopause, when that's no longer an issue, are women with a history of PCOS any more likely to develop uterine cancer postmenopause than someone who did not have PCOS? Is that known?
So I do believe the answer to that is yes. And the question is, and I don't know if this has been teased out, is that because there's more patients who are obese and carrying extra fat cells produces more estrogen in general, and that puts people at risk, or is it from the PCOS itself? The way I think about it is that uterine cancer just doesn't happen, we know, right? It sort of becomes sort of mildly abnormal, what we call hyperplasia, and then a little bit more severe, and then really severe. And there's several stages as you go from normal uterine cells under the microscope to cancer. And I see a lot of patients with PCOS who have what we call endometrial hyperplasia that have these precancerous cells in their uterus. Those are people who, over the course of years and years and years, we get our period when we're, whatever, let's say 13, and when patients are 33, they've already been having periods or lack of periods all the time for 20 years and have had that sort of unexposed estrogen affecting their body for a really long time. Yeah. So I think about it as like, it's something that sort of, as you go through your life, you're sort of longer and longer exposure to the estrogen definitely can increase the risk over time.
My sense of all of this is, when really advising women with a history of PCOS, what they should be most concerned about when they are postmenopause is not all that different than what we tell all women. It's really about cardiovascular disease, diabetes, and all of those risk factors, acknowledging that they are certainly at higher risk than the general population, but have to do all the same things that we advise every other woman to do. And then, of course, the other question, which has not been studied, of course, is about hormone therapy specifically in this population. Because when you look at all of the studies out there on hormone therapy, which really show that it started early, that it is protective against cardiovascular disease, protective against diabetes, protective against uterine cancer, protective against breast cancer and all that, it's not like they ever ask any of these women, did you have PCOS when you were younger? So we don't know, unless there's something you know that I don't know, but I look at that literature pretty carefully and I have never, ever seen any commentary or study looking specifically if women with a history of PCOS do better, worse, or the same than the general population when it comes to hormone therapy.
Yeah, I agree with you. I mean, theoretically, you know, you think like longer exposure to estrogen is not ideal, although estrogen plus progesterone, maybe it's beneficial if you're combining those two. But like, let's say you have someone who had a hysterectomy, right? Who has history of PCOS. If you gave that patient estrogen, you know, would they still have the protective effects of the estrogen?
I can't imagine why they wouldn't. I mean, honestly, but as a menopause expert, if someone came to me and said, I have a history of PCOS, is there any reason I shouldn't take hormone therapy? I would say, no, if anything, you're someone that I would strongly advise to take it because we're worried. We're worried about diabetes. We're worried about these potential increase in cardiac inflammatory markers that maybe you had that someone else didn't have. So I don't know. But then on the flip side of it, just to make it more complicated, we know that if you look at women who start hormone therapy 10 or 15 years after the menopause transition, a lot of them have already had damage to their vascular system because of a lot of these issues. And is a PCOS woman more like someone who's older? I don't know. I don't know. But certainly it's something that is worth studying and it's knowable information. I mean, we can do an evaluation. I mean, you know, get someone in with a cardiologist, do an evaluation of what their blood vessels look like, look at their cardiac risks, and then make a determination if hormone therapy would be a good thing for them or a bad thing?
Well, and we know all the reasons why when we lose the estrogen, there's lots of symptoms from that, and lots of health consequences.
But then we also we have to think about, okay, we didn't really talk a lot about women with PCOS have more androgens than women without PCOS. Androgens being, of course, we think of things like testosterone and androgens as being male hormones. They are not. They are human hormones. Women have them as much as men do, and they have all kinds of important purposes in women. But PCOS women tend to have a little bit more, which is why they get the acne and the hair growth and all of that. So there's that impact as well on their lifelong metabolic status. They probably have great bones because all those androgens probably really help build their bones and muscles. Yay.
These are, unless you've got the family history, you're fair, so you haven't had enough vitamin D, you've been on steroids and you're thin and you have PCOS, then you kind of have the worst of it all.
But I think the overriding message as we talk about this is we know so much now about PCOS that we did not know before. As long as someone is under the age of 50, we are just starting to get emerging data into, okay, this is something that does impact later in life. And when before I talked to you and I was, scouting around in terms of the articles to make myself a little bit more knowledgeable about this stuff, because it's not anything I learned during my residency. And it wasn't like there were a ton of articles out there on PCOS and menopause. I only came across really two relatively recent reviews that looked at this stuff and a lot of unanswered questions.
Well, it seems like hopefully we'll get some more answers as time goes on.
Is there anything I haven't asked you about this particular topic or that you wanted to add?
People with PCOS need to advocate for themselves. There's a lot of really smart internists out there, but a lot of people may not be asking about, hey, when you were 20 and 30, did you have PCOS? Did you have regular periods when you were younger? I can't imagine internists asking those kind of
They're
questions.
not even asking about menopause, so don't get me started on that.
So, I mean, you need to advocate for yourself and make sure you're being screened, making sure you're getting screened for cardiovascular disease, making sure your cholesterol is being checked.
I have to confess, as someone who does mostly menopause, I've been kind of out of the loop with a lot of this stuff. But it doesn't matter if all I'm doing is menopause. I still need to keep up with it. I so appreciate your knowledge. I so appreciate the fact that you have enlightened me. And thank you for taking this time.
Oh, thank you so much for having me. It was so much fun.
All right, so the wrap up for this whole thing. It's well established that young women with PCOS commonly have irregular periods, infertility, and excess hair growth, along with an increased risk for elevated cholesterol, high blood pressure, metabolic syndrome, diabetes, obesity, sleep apnea, and cardiovascular disease. And if a woman's not ovulating, which is very typical of PCOS, there can also be an abnormal buildup in the lining of the uterus, which increases the risk for uterine cancer. No news there. We've known this for a long time. The issues post-menopause, not as well established. But what does seem to be the case is that women with PCOS enter menopause roughly 4 years later than women without PCOS. And prior to menopause is when women with PCOS tend to, sometimes for the first time in their life, have regular periods and even ovulate. And while we used to tell women that once you're in menopause, your PCOS troubles are over, we know that's not the case. It appears that women with PCOS are still at increased risk of cardiovascular disease, type 2 diabetes, and possibly sleep apnea. Even though the risk of uterine cancer is definitely increased in young women with PCOS, it's unclear if that risk continues post-menopause. There just haven't been enough studies. But good news is that women with a history of PCOS don't need to avoid menopausal hormone therapy, and there may even be an advantage over the general population, but another area that needs more studies. And finally, one thing that didn't come up during the conversation, but I wanted to mention, is that PCOS can't be diagnosed post-menopause. So if you're wondering if perhaps you had PCOS when you were younger, there's really no way to know for sure. After we finished our conversation about PCOS, Dr. Rogers and I got into a whole nother discussion about egg freezing and the impact of in vitro fertilization and other fertility treatments later in life. But I'm saving that for another episode. I'm Dr. Lauren Stryker, and thank you for joining me. You will find lots more information in my Inside Information books available on Amazon.com. And follow Francie as she navigates her way through vaginal dryness, hot flashes, and pretty much every menopausal symptom you can think of.
Sometimes I feel blue. She helped me see the light. Now I'm sleeping through the night.